All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. And welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, episode number 49, so one off 50. Are we going to do something special for the 50th episode? We're going to have to.
Nah, I don't reckon.
Nah. Yeah, allow it, man. Allow it.
Just allow it off, yeah? Should we just not bother? Nah, we'll wait for the big one then, shall we? But the preamble ramble this week, and we don't talk enough about Birmingham City, really, our sort of like home clubs, because a lot of our listeners are, you know, from the Midlands, and they support Birmingham City, they support Aston Villa. So we don't really speak enough about them, but we're gonna open our preamble ramble about it this week, because there's been a lot of attention, hasn't there? And, you know, with the hashtag, the BHSL out hashtag, that's been very popular this week. And obviously Ian Danton has been on TalkSport talking to Simon Jordan and Jim White about sort of like all the troubles at Blues, really. And the circumstances are, I would say, dire and probably the worst that I've known them since being a fan at the minute. And I think Blues fans are under no illusions either. And we have a certain like apathetic nature to our support, you know, that subsidises some of the anguish and mediocrity that we've become accustomed to for, you know, virtually my whole generation, apart from that 2011 Carling Cup win, which was a bit of an anomaly. You know, and obviously there's a lot of teams in the Championship, especially, that can point fingers at the owners. So I'm not saying that Blues fans should be treated any different to, you know, these clubs like Portsmouth, Bradford, Charlton, Bolton, all these teams that have had bad mismanagement from, you know, from the sort of top downwards. So, you know, we're just going to talk about Blues and focus on Blues because obviously they're one of our teams. Well, my team, Flynn, obviously your brother's a big fan. You're probably a Blues fan if you had to choose one. You know, Jim, obviously you care about your mates and you care about the situation that Blues are in. So just to give a context to the people listening that aren't Blues fans and perhaps don't know how bad the situation is, since getting relegated from the Premier League in 2011, we've only had one season where we finished above 10th in the league. So that's 10 seasons. That was when we finished fourth in our first season down in the Championship under Chris Hughton. Our previous five seasons finished like this: 19th, 19th, 17th, 20th, 18th. And we currently sit in 18th after a 6-2 absolute demolition by Fulham. To be fair, which isn't, you know, it's not as disgraceful as it sounds because Fulham have scored 19 goals in the last three games. But if you go onto Wikipedia, which is the fountain of all knowledge, you'll find a subheading under Birmingham City ownership called the Chinese Years. And this will be the period from 2007 until now, which started with Carson Young, the phony hairdresser, becoming the biggest single shareholder prior to his criminal conviction in 2014 for money laundering. Around that time, a mysterious company called Trillion Trophy Asia, that has a registered office address in the British Virgin Islands, an unknown head office address and very media-shy directors. Basically, they were the benefactor of struck deals with previous major shareholders in a way that legal action would be dropped in return for an agreement not to obstruct the transfer ownership to TTA. So this culminated in Birmingham International Holdings share capital to the sole Chinese businessman, Paul Swen Chohong. So that sounds complicated, but honestly, it gets a lot deeper and I don't want to go too much on that. I've been using a lot of information from a guy called Daniel, and you probably recognize his Twitter handle as Al Majir. He's been processing all this information for the last, I don't know, I want to say decade. I think he had another blog a few years ago, but he's basically been sort of like keeping his ear to the ground in terms of this information. But to cut a long story short, this ownership since 2007, they've failed in every department of football ownership that you possibly can. The fans now feel so disenfranchised from the club that they don't even want to go to home games, even when they can. So the whole business with the stadium is the straw that broke the camel's back, as really poor performance has become a dime a dozen, but the reality of relegation to the third tier has become so present in Blues fans' mind that some would welcome it rather than fear it.
And I think maybe more than welcoming it, Blues fans have just accepted it. The team, they just can't keep flirting with relegation and then surviving on the last day. At some point, it's going to happen, and I think they will go down. It's the same thing every season. They have a bad run. They sack the manager near the end of the season, just as it looks like they're going down. Then they appoint a new manager who keeps them up, and then he's then lauded as a hero. And this just happens again and again every season. As you've pointed out there, Bissett, something's wrong behind the scenes. And I checked out that blog, almajir.net. Something I didn't see alleged there is that two of the directors, including the then CEO, were caught spending just under £7,000 in Dior, Prada and Gucci in Barcelona using the Birmingham City Football Club's credit card. Other expenses charged to this account reportedly include tickets to Cineworld and a subscription to Netflix. Now, I don't see how these purchases benefit the club unless the Netflix account is used for the whole team. But a question for you guys, though. How does this all get fixed? Is there a way to fix this, or is what's going to happen next?
It's a difficult one because they've been entrenched in this unhealthy financial situation for so long. Who would want to take on Birmingham City Football Club as a commercial venture? With Derby being in the position that they're in, I think Mike Ashley put in a bid for them, didn't they? And like just to get them on the cheap and try and elevate their value, kind of like he did with Newcastle. I could possibly see someone like that doing something like that. But you can imagine the financial paperwork, the labyrinth of, you know, whatever mess has been left behind by this situation. It seems like it'd be more of a headache, especially since they're not the most... Like they're not commercially a standing, are they? They don't move loads of shirt sales. They don't have any marquee players as such. They're quite an, forgive me, Bissett, but they're quite an unfashionable club, aren't they? So it seems bleak, really. And as we've said loads and loads of times, mismanagement at every level. It's like such a difficult thing to try and pull everything back, roll it back so it makes a little bit more sense. It just seems like it's absolutely fucked up Blues at the minute.
Yeah, I can't disagree with what you just said, Jim, to be fair. You know, I don't think Blues are a particularly popular club. You know, I think a lot of Blues fans, and I said earlier, you know, a lot of Blues fans are under no illusions. But if you ask the current fans of the 20 Premier League teams that are there at the minute, would you like to see Birmingham back in the Premier League? How many of them would really say, all right, yeah, they're a club that should be back up there? You know, like a lot of teams fans said about Leeds when they were down in League One. And what probably a lot of people say about Sunderland as well. You know, they're the sort of teams that people perhaps want to see back up there. Maybe Aston Villa, they want to see Aston Villa back in the Premier League because their history winning the European Cup, et cetera, et cetera. But Blues haven't really got a history of winning trophies. Obviously, they had that cup shock in 2011 that we mentioned earlier against Arsenal. But, you know, apart from that, you got an LDV Trans Vans trophy win in 1995 against Tranmere. And then, which people don't even probably they've never even heard of. And then you're going back a long way, I think, to the next trophy. So we're not particularly, we've never really been successful. Obviously, our one defining sort of, you know, cup win. And alongside that is our sort of like wins against Villa when we came up in, you know, when we first came up, was it 2005, 2006, something like that? And we beat Villa back to back. That's kind of like, you know, if you were going to say to Blues fans, what are your highlights over the last 20 years, that'd be it. But do Blues fans deserve what's going on at the minute that's happened for the last 13, 14 years with the club? Absolutely not. We thought that moving on from Gold and Sullivan and Brady would be a good thing for the club, you know, but sometimes you realise that the grass isn't greener on the other side, and we'd kill to have owners like them back in the club right now. Do you know what I mean? They've gone to West Ham. They've done a really good job there. Business smart people that know the ins and outs of the industry. They know the ins and outs of fans and how to connect with fans. They know the importance of, you know, making sure that fans feel respected and they feel that they're still a part of the club. And at the moment, with that disenfranchised like nature that Blues fans have, it's just they've just completely lost all trust in this ownership at the minute. And you know, and you got teams like Derby, and I think they've put out a statement today. That looks kind of, you know, you look at it, and I was reading it earlier and I was like, this is a bit wishy-washy, man. This sounds like pretty bad. They're saying that they've got prospective owners, and then, you know, they're also saying that, oh, we're not sure about where it's going and stuff like that. We're not sure how to get the preferred bidder in place. So there's huge problems with a lot of football clubs, and it all comes down to, you know, what we've spoke about before and the fit and proper persons test that the EFL supposedly employ that protects football clubs from, you know, sort of dodgy ownership and, you know, people coming in and saying they've got amounts of money and saying they're going to run the team in a certain way and saying they're going to invest this amount of money, X amount of money. And it turns out that they're just frauds, really. And it turns out that they really don't know how to manage a football club. So the buck falls at the EFL, man, to be honest. At the end of the day, they should have a responsibility to make sure that English Football League clubs are spending within their means. You know, they don't have to spend extortionate money on transfers and wages, and it doesn't get out of hand. And this fit and proper persons test essentially should be eradicated. It should be, you know, a new version of itself should come out, because English Football League clubs are not being protected at all. And it's a crying shame, because you're going to see more teams that drop out of the football leagues in the next 10 years unless something is done about it. And as I said, like, ultimately the buck falls with the EFL.
Alarm bells should be ringing when prospective owners report that they made their fortune from like a hair moose stand in Mozambique or something. Do you know what I mean? You don't have to be a detective to figure that out, do you, really?
Does anyone see anything coming of this this topic trending on Twitter?
Ultimately, what can come of it? I understand that, you know, people get behind things like this, don't they? Now in the social media age, we can get behind it, like a Twitter handle, people hashtag and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it brings attention to the cause, which is fair. You know, that's what we want. But how much are the Chinese owners that have had virtually no communication with anybody, really, with the fans, especially very little communication with the media or any sources connected with the game? Like, are they really, do they even know about it for a start? You know what I mean? And secondly, are they really going to want to change? Are they really going to take it under consideration and think, well, you know what? Yeah, we'll sell the club to somebody because of this. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to say where it goes, isn't it? But, and protest at the end of the day, that's how things get changed in all walks of life, isn't it? So a protest like at the ground would probably be more effective. You might disagree. You might say that now in the social media age that, like, you know, something on social media may be more effective, but I think a protest at the ground would be more effective. That's kind of how Xuandong Ren kind of left his post. There was a big following of Blues fans on social media and at the grounds that they wanted the chairman out and ultimately ended up resigning. So whether this is going to work on a bigger scale and actually get the owners to sell the club, obviously there's a lot of technical and complex things that need to be considered when it comes to something like that. But, you know, ultimately we'll have to wait and see on that behalf.
I just feel really bad for you now, Bissett. I just feel really, really sad.
It's a sad state of affairs, because at the end of the day, you know, the teams in the Premier League, like the big, let's say the big eight, will include Arsenal, you know, Tottenham, Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester City, Man United. They're certainly not going anywhere anytime soon. Obviously, Newcastle just been bought. We'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But they seem like, you know, the owners so far seem like in this transfer window, they're not just splashing money out. They're not going silly yet. We'll have to wait and see at the end of January if they make any sort of like last minute signings. But it just shows you, like, football clubs all around, you know, all around the league, even in the Premier League, are having problems. Obviously, Benitez sacked by Everton, which was ultimately inevitable. And, you know, just before Christmas, we spoke about the fragility of his position as Everton manager after Mashiri sacked director of football Marcel Brands in early December. He'd been in that position for much of the Mashiri reign so far, and certainly the responsibility of Everton's poor player recruitment strategy over the last few years fell at his feet. Rafa can't be held to the same accountability regarding player signings, but Everton's performance on the field have failed to impress in his 200 days in management of the club. And I think growing sentiment amongst fans is that he was destined to fail, really, at Goodison Park after his attachment with Liverpool in his six-year spell there. He's now become the sixth manager to be sacked under Mashiri after failed experiments with Ancelotti, Marco Silva, Sam Allardyce, Ronald Koeman, and Roberto Martinez, who he sacked in May 2016, who, ironically, is one of the favourites to take over the position permanently, following, obviously, his impressive stint as Belgium coach. But such is the triviality of football management in the Premier League.
During his time with Liverpool, Benitez did refer once to Everton as a small club. I don't know if you guys saw the interview.
Yeah.
It was a super offhand comment, but that was hard. You know, the fans were hardly going to warm to him after that. But I just also wanted to go back to Martinez. There's been reports, I believe today, that the Belgian FA have reportedly rejected Everton's advances. Now, whilst this hasn't ruled Martinez out completely, do you think it could leave room for like a Rooney or a Lampard to step in?
I said a couple of weeks ago, I think Rooney's like pretty much the preferred favourite. Look at the job he's done at Derby and all that. They've been kicked while they've been down for the last couple of months, and he's steadied the ship, got them off bottom after all those deductions they suffered. And I think going back to your initial point about Benitez, he's inextricably linked with Liverpool and that victory in Istanbul. He's such an entrenched part of their history that a lot of Everton fans would have had trouble warming to him anyway. I also think that you can't let that kind of team loyalty get in the way of supporting a manager. I don't know. Do you reckon that Benitez has had the full support of fans? Probably not. But if he was getting better results, it wouldn't really matter, would it? I don't think.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it does come. It's a results-based business, isn't it? And I think football fans, you know, we're very fickle at the end of the day. No matter how much bad blood there has been between a previous manager and fans, if they come in and they start getting results on the pitch, no matter who they are, generally they're going to turn 99% of fans around. Obviously, there is bad blood in Liverpool between them and the sort of Everton fans. But I think, I wonder if the frugality that Everton's shown in the transfer market in the summer has probably or possibly hurt them. And, you know, I think that they've sort of desperately tried to rectify that already in the transfer window so far in January. They've signed fullbacks Vitali, Mike Olenko and Nathan Patterson for very considerable fees. I think one was about 24 million euros and another one was 14 million euros. Anwar El Ghazi has arrived on loan from Villa, which makes like very little sense to me. He's barely had any playing time since Gerrard's gone in at Villa. Obviously, it makes sense for him because he's going to get game time. But for me, I don't know how he fits into the sort of Everton setup. But ultimately, I think a part of their downfall has been since Mashiri's coming in 2016. I think they're reaping the repercussions of extremely poor transfers. Alex Iwobi, 30 million when he couldn't get into the Arsenal team. Moise Keane, 27.5 million, never adapted to Premier League, perhaps wasn't given enough time. Jean-Philippe Gbamin signed for 25 million, only four league appearances for Everton since signing in August 2019. Richarlison, nearly 40 million for the then 20-year-old from Watford after scoring five goals in 38 games. Had a couple of decent seasons in the first few years, but only managed seven in 34 last year for the Toffees. And the list really goes on. And we haven't even mentioned the likes of Davy Klaassen. I think he was 25-odd million. Gylfi Sigurdsson, who I think is under a child sexual assault case or something at the moment. James Rodriguez. I'm hoping I'm right on that, or else I've just absolutely defamed him. But I'm pretty sure he's in trouble.
I'm so James, happy I was muted for that, man. Sorry.
James Rodriguez, you know, what can you say about him? He was, I don't know how much he was on his loan. I think he was on a loan fee, wasn't he? He was on a lot of money, I'd imagine. Theo Walcott, he was there for what, 70 odd games, five goals ish, probably past his time, past his prime. Yannick Bolasie, I think, made 25, 30 appearances, was there for 4 or 5 years. And like, I could go on ad nauseum really on the poor quality of the signings in general. And I think, you know, obviously starting off with Blues and the way they've been ran, it ran in a completely different way. Different levels of financial investment, but it really puts the complexity of running a football club into perspective. And like a team, you know, that team and a club culture and a footballing philosophy on and off the field, like it can't be bought. But I'd say Everton, ultimately, they need stability and a foundation, and they need to instill a huge element of trust in their next managerial appointment. Someone that they can essentially, you know, allow to transform the club from top to bottom. And even, you know, and this will sort of grieve Everton fans listening, and I've been saying this about Blues for you know a couple of years as well now. Even if it means relegation, getting rid of the deadwood, starting from the bottom, using the academy, because Blues have had a good academy, Everton have got a good academy, but so they're in similar situations in a way. Do you know what I mean? So I think that there's potential there that if they did get relegated, they could build up, because you see a lot of teams that do that. They drop a few leagues. Leeds have been one that's done it, and they're in a relatively good situation at the minute. You know, so you can do it. Teams can do that. Norwich, they've been a up and down sort of team, yo-yo team for a while. West Brom have been one of those teams. Fulham, they've been one of those teams for the last like 10 years, and now they're destroying the Championship. Like, you know, some of these teams, there should be a league somewhere in between the Premier League and the Championship sometimes. You know what I mean? It's like they've got the quality of the Premier League, perhaps not got the sort of resources to stay there long term, but they're just far better than the Championship. There's such a huge dividing quality there. And I think it mainly comes down to the amount of money that's pumped into teams when teams do get promoted. And then when they get relegated, they've got these sort of like players on high wages that really shouldn't be there. So the quality, you know, golfing quality is really, really clear to see.
I've got a couple of questions there for you, Bissett. So I just want to go back to the whole idea of being relegated and getting rid of the deadwood. How easy is it to find buyers for this deadwood, for these players?
I would say very, very difficult sometimes, especially, and this is kind of like one of the, and we're going to talk about Blues again here, because I'm going to talk about Nikola Zigic, who became a bit of a cult hero, really, with Blues. I believe in 2011, when we got relegated, he was in either his first or second year of his contract, and he was on a five-year deal. And at the time, in 2011, he was on 55 or 60 grand a year, I want to say, which was, I think he was one of the highest paid earners in Birmingham City history, unless I'm mistaken. And anyway, he had 3 or 4 years left on his contract. So there's no way you're getting rid of him, because at the end of the day, he's entitled to just essentially wait his 3 or 4 years out on his contract. The club has given him a contract of a certain length, and he's within his rights to just, you know, if the management doesn't want to play him because they think, all right, we're trying to get him off the books. If the management doesn't want to play him, he can just turn up to training 5 days a week, not playing any games, and just sit out his 3 years and make 55, 60 grand a week. And there's, you know, nothing that nobody can really do about it, unless they come to terms like, who was it recently for Arsenal that left? Willian. He left. He obviously came from Chelsea to Arsenal. He was on a big wage, 150 grand, I think, or something of that nature. They signed him on a free contract. He was there for what, a season or two. And he wanted to go and play back in his home Brazil. So he came to terms with Arsenal that they could mutually terminate their contract so he could go and play football, and Arsenal wouldn't be paying him extortionate amounts of money. I don't think they had to pay him any compensation. So that was kind of like, oh, we don't really see this. We don't really see a footballer that kind of helps the club out by getting himself off the wage bill. And then obviously to go and play football, a lot of footballers just will stay there, rot, and just make a good living. So to answer your question, it can be really, really difficult to get rid of deadwood.
To go back to Blues again, for example, like say if Everton go down, they get rid of this deadwood, what's to stop them being another Blues? They went down, a lot of people said that at the time, and it's, what is it, 10 years they've been down there?
Yeah, and there is nothing really stopping it. And Everton, I mean, let's get the comparisons in perspective. Everton are a much bigger club than Blues, and some Blues fans are probably gonna not like this, not like that. You know, that's not gonna be like music to Blues fans' ears. But I would say Everton, and I'm sure you two would both agree with me, are a much better, bigger club. And it's tough. You hear about this, oh, they're a big club. You know, it's a sort of general sort of football term that gets bandied around quite a bit. What makes a club big? Is it the fan base? Is it their history? Is it how many trophies they've won? You know what I mean? Is it how many shirt sales they sell? Is it how much the players are on? How much money they're making? So it's very, very difficult to quantify what makes a big club. But I could see a team like Everton. I wouldn't see them having an issue bouncing back up. But look at Sheffield Wednesday. You would class them as a big club. Obviously, they weren't in the Premier League for the longest time, and then they got relegated to League One. And I think they're somewhere mid-table in League One. There's a lot of big clubs down in League One that have suffered this sort of double relegation, and that's the kind of like can be a bit of a nail in the coffin for some clubs. Obviously, there's a small percentage that do go down there and bounce all the way back up, like Norwich did, like Leeds did. Just off the top of my head, there's probably a couple more that have done it as well. Brentford have been down in League One. Swansea were down in, I think, in League Two. They were up in the Premier League for a considerable amount of time. Now they've kind of like leveled off in the Championship. So, you know, it swings around about, but yeah, there's nothing to say that Everton, you know, could potentially just languish in the Championship for another 10 years. But ultimately, they will want to stay in the Premier League. But, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, it's not the end of the world. You know what I mean? For Everton fans.
Now, you mentioned a little bit ago, Everton are going to need someone who can bring stability and a foundation if they've got any chance of staying up. What about the current caretaker manager? He's been with the club a long time. Didn't he refuse to go to Real Madrid as a coach at one point? Do you think he could be the man for the job?
Who? Big Dunk. Big Dunk and Ferguson.
Big Dunk, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is his third time being caretaker manager, or second time. I think they had David Unsworth, I think, took over. I think that might have been when when Roberto Martinez was sacked in 2016. I think he came in as a caretaker. But that's what he's going to be. He's going to be a caretaker. I don't think there's anything... I don't see a future of him managing that team. I think he's a bit of a nutcase, man. Like, honestly, I'm sure he had a bit of an issue. Like, the last time he was caretaker manager about... He said something, like, something you just can't say as a head coach for a manager in the Premier League. I can't remember exactly what it was. I'd have to... I'll try and dig it up and maybe we'll talk about it next week. But I can't see him being there for any considerable amount of time. Maybe he'll rejuvenate the players for a couple of weeks and they'll go through the Flynn honeymoon period for six games. Maybe they get a couple of results. Who knows? But they've just lost to Norwich 2-1, haven't they? Norwich were bottom of the league. They scored 2 goals in 2 minutes. Couldn't get back into the game. Everton. I think they've won 1 in the last 7 with some really poor results sprinkled in there. So it's going to take... And I know they're only 6 points. They're 6 points off relegation, I think. So they're not really in the danger zone yet. But if they don't get a win in the next 4 or 5 games, you know what I mean? You could be looking at them being very perilously close. So they're going to need somebody quickly to come and turn the club around.
Yeah, well, I watched a highlight video of Everton versus Liverpool from about 3 or 4 seasons ago, maybe even more than that. And Everton used to have a sick squad, you know. There was Lukaku, Delafeo, Morales, Steven Pienaar. Who else did they have? A couple of, like, sick players. And it was, like, 3-3 in the end. I think they were 3-1 down, brought it back. They're not that team, not even, like, anywhere near that team, even from a few years ago. So you can see the instability at the top end of the club is really the consequences of that are showing on the pitch. Like, you wouldn't fancy that team from a few years ago to just not be able to like reverse a 1-goal deficit against bottom of the league, would you? So it's not great reading for Everton fans.
Well, we were talking about, you know, the way they managed the transfer market, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years under Moshiri. And you look at the signings they made in the summer. And, you know, obviously I said earlier that maybe them being frugal earlier in the summer has been, you know, a bad idea, but you look at the signings they made in the summer. Damari Gray, we spoke about him probably being one of the better signings of the year. 1.7 million or whatever it was. Andros Townsend, a free transfer. I think they're both. I think Damari Gray is their top goal scorer. Andros Townsend on about 3 goals. So there's a couple of good, decent signings and spent very little. So, you know, is there a way for them to do something similar? Or can they just be a bit more like sort of, you know, frugal in the transfer market and make that work? So, I don't know. We'll have to see. But I think I definitely think they would need a manager that's going to come in and really set a culture and a playing philosophy and really get them back onto a level playing field with teams like their rivals Liverpool, because they're a million miles off them at the moment, aren't they?
Just while we're on the subject of Everton, I just want to go back to you slating Alex Iwobi. Now, I feel like I remember you saying in a previous episode, I tried finding it, and I couldn't quite find it, but I've got a feeling it was episode 39.
That that long ago?
It was that long ago that Nigeria, you said they might be your favourite to win the AFCON because they have players like Iwobi.
Oh, mate, this was probably last week. Yeah, this was probably last week. Don't even say it was like, you don't even need to say it was 10 weeks ago or whatever. It was most probably last week. And like, no disrespect to like the AFCON combinations, but there's a big difference between playing against Sudan and like Sierra Leone than playing against teams in the Premier League. So, I mean, yeah, I'd say Alex Iwobi in the Nigeria team. And I don't think he's not even a starter in that Nigeria team. But, you know, he was a name that sprung out to me as being, you know, part of a decent squad that Nigeria have. And to be fair, I'm relatively justified so far. They've won 3 out of 3 in their group stages. So they're the only team to do that in the group stages so far. So, and I think he started their last game at Iwobi. I'm not sure how he played, but they're looking pretty decent, Nigeria. But yeah, big gulf in quality between playing in the AFCON and playing in the Premier League, I'd say.
Getting rid of Iwobi for 30 million. That's a good bit of business from Arsenal. Like, he's not worth 30
bit of business, man. I don't think he played for him for like fucking 12 months when they sold him. It was an absolute shock when Everton paid 30 million for him.
I seen Iwobi play at Stoke, and to be fair, it was one of the worst games of football and one of the coldest days I've been to, and Iwobi was a shocker, man. So I was happy when he was put out the door.
Yeah, I bet. Should we go over the Premier League midweek games? There was a couple of crackers, really. Obviously, Tottenham with that 3-2 win last night. And I've seen something on Twitter. It's like, how will I tell my kids what happened in this game? It was like Leicester 2, Tottenham won, and there was 94 minutes, 30 seconds on the clock. How will I tell my kids that Tottenham won this game? Obviously, Steven Bergwijn scored two goals in like less than 60 seconds. Absolute sickener for Leicester fans. And a fan was on talks, but earlier saying he left, a Tottenham fan was saying he left in the 88th minute, which is nearly as bad as the thousands of fans that left the City ground in 2012. When City were losing to QPR, and then there was the old Aguero.
You know, Kane's goal, as much as we slag him off, yeah, Kane's goal was sick.
And his ball, he's like incisive through ball for the third, for Bergwijn.
Oh,
second.
Yeah, yeah. Should join the curling team, man.
Levels, mate, absolute levels. Sorry, did you see a massive bang?
I did, yeah. Is it your mate? Is it your brother-in-law?
Smashing the place up. It's all good. Just cut that out. We can keep that one. I'm going to go and shout him in Polish in a minute.
Fucking kurwa, mate. Absolute kurwa.
Kurwa. He's always saying that, to be fair to.
94 minutes and 52 seconds. This is the latest time a team has begun a comeback from a losing position. And it's funny that you should mention the Man City comeback, as that was the previous record holder.
Nice one, stat man, Flynn.
Oh, I'm a stat man.
He's a stat.
Nah. Now, I would have thought that record belonged to praise be Alex Ferguson, the old Fergie time.
Oh yeah, yeah, you think so, innit? You think so. Maybe was that a comeback in Barcelona versus United? Maybe that's like one of the best European ones when Solskjaer scored a couple later on.
That was against Bayern, wasn't it? But I think it was at the Nou Camp. I think it was at
this
the Nou Camp.
This is a Premier League record, remember?
Okay, so there you go. Maybe Fergie's got a few in other competitions. But yeah, speaking of Fergie and his Man United, so his Man United team, they kind of still are. I'd say if you watch this game, the first half, it was a really Jekyll and Hyde sort of performance for United. David De Gea, absolutely heroic in the first half. You know, I think Brentford accumulated like 2.75, something like that, XG in the first half. And really just kept them at bay, made two outstanding saves with his feet, where, you know, one-on-ones essentially. So he was, you know, he's been brilliant. Obviously, you know, he's been there for 10 years now. He's been brilliant, I think, in his whole career at United. He probably will go down as, you know, spoke about in the same breath as, you know, Peter Schmeichel, I think, when he hangs up his boots for United. But United's quality really shone in the second half. Fantastic second goal, I think it was, where Ronaldo sort of chested the ball off to Bruno Fernandes. He sprang through. Mason Greenwood was up with him and just slid it past. Great counter-attacking football. So I'd say in terms of their attacking quality, probably the best under Ranić so far, but still defensively, they look frail, man. They do look really suspect in defence at the moment. So I think that's something he'll want to probably get sorted out.
They'll be happy to get Rashford back on the score sheet, though. That was a nice finish from him just to put the game to bed. Kind of looked like a casual finish from a player who's really been searching for confidence lately. So hopefully he can build on that in the coming weeks. Like him and Sancho, it's been going a bit haywire for them lately. So yeah, let's hope their improvement can converge with United's overall.
Yeah, as you say, he really needed that. I think he got given, what, the last 10 minutes, was it, or something like that? And with the emergence of Anthony Elanga, who looked, for me, looked really, really good when he came on a couple of weeks ago. I think he came off the bench and obviously he's been rewarded with the start. And obviously Ranić likes him, or else I don't think he'd put that much trust in him, because they needed to get a win, really, because they were two goals up against Villa. They let that lead slip. So really, when they went 2-0 up, I think Ranić tried to really solidify. And he obviously had to take off Ronaldo, which was, it's just always an ultra brave thing to do for a manager, because you don't want to take him off. And he was absolutely furious, man. You wanted to see his face. Obviously, he didn't want to, initially he didn't want to shake his hand, but he's a professional. You know, when he gets back in the dressing room, Ronaldo's going to understand, because Ranić just needs to say to him, look, I want to keep you fresh for games coming up. Obviously, he brought Harry Maguire on. I think they must have gone to a back three, I believe. I think they shifted Diogo Dalot to a wing-back position, and they had Alex Tellers on the field as well, and I think he went to left wing-back. But yeah, I'd say it's a decent performance, but just don't look solid. I think David De Gea is keeping him in games a lot of times. So yeah, you know, you come up against a better side, and I think they're going to come unstuck again.
Like in the Chelsea game, this is the latest in a long run of their slip since a really good start to the beginning of the season. They're not quite crumbling defensively to the same extent that United are, but they're definitely not the team that we've seen, say, 2 or 3 months ago. They were red hot for a good while there. Like, what's happening there?
I think in regards to Chelsea, what they were doing very well when Tuchel first took over, and I think that we might have said on the podcast a few months ago when he did first take over, that they had certain records in regards to clean sheets. And I think Mendy in goal had so many consecutive clean sheets. And we were saying, like, you know, he had a 66% win rate at one point over the span of, like, I don't know, 17 games or something like that. And I think it's because they were winning 1-0. You know what I mean? They were winning by the odd goal. And I think what they're really struggling to sort of score goals. And, like, the Chelsea, we know, have always been free-flowing and, you know, free scoring. And I think it's partly because of that. I don't think they're scoring as many goals as they were when he first took over. And it is just more drop points. I think it's only one win in the last 7, with obviously a couple of draws against Brighton thrown in there. And to be fair, over that 7 games, they have played Liverpool. They drew 2-2. They lost to Man City. They beat Villa. They beat Villa 3-1, obviously the game we were at. And that's their only win, I think, in the last 7. But they've been tough games, but really, you'd expect them to be taking at least 4 points over 2 games against Brighton, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, the goal was good anyway. What was it, Ziyech? Is that the one who scored?
Yeah, Ziyech. And he's starting to come into form, you know, and sometimes that can be good for a player. So when teams are going through a bad patch of form, you will find that certain players use that sort of situation and sort of start to flourish. And I think he's starting, and they paid a lot of money for him as well. So he's starting to sort of come into his own now. And to be fair, they've got such a wealth of talent on the bench. Who was it? I don't know if it was their last game or the game before. It might have been against Tottenham. They had players on the bench, like Jorginho was on the bench, Mason Mount was on the bench. You know, so they got some real quality players, like, just at their disposal. Callum Hudson-Odoi sometimes doesn't get into the team. You know, they've got such a breadth of talent. Timo Werner, you know, he's still a great player. Romelu Lukaku, he's been sort of playing more, but not really scoring as many goals as we thought. You know, when Jim, me and you were saying, like, when he comes back to the Premier League, he's got that experience. He's won the league with Inter Milan, played under Mancini. Like, he's got this sort of nutritionist that he's been working with. He looks leaner, meaner, still got the pace though. And we thought he was going to be a great fit to the Premier League, but how many goals has he scored? He scored a handful.
Well, not as many as I was expecting him to score, but at the same time, he's had a little bit of a falling out with Tuchel. He's probably not playing the same role as the front man as he was at Inter. The games in the Premier League aren't quite as open. It's not as top heavy as a league overall. So there's a lot of factors into why he's not been able to reproduce that form, but he's definitely underachieved so far. I know it's still basically early days. He could go on a hot run for the next 15 games, score one every game, and then that's me, like, you know, talking shit on it. But for the minute, I feel like it's been a little bit of a stuttering start for Lukaku, definitely.
And obviously, you know, we're looking at Premier League table now and thinking, right, it is Man City's, isn't it? Like, there's no real way, unless they go on some horrible run where they don't win in 5 or 6 games and Liverpool do 5 or 6 on the bounce to sort of even it up. There's very little chance of anyone really getting back into that that Premier League race. But we'll quickly have a roundup of the African Cup of Nations, which I've kind of watched a couple of games, but have either of you really tuned into much of this? Obviously, apart from last week where we were sort of highlighting the woes, they've kind of got over that, it seems. And, you know, it's becoming less of a meme. Hopefully, when we go deep into the tournament now, it will start being a bit more, you know, a bit more respect sort of given to it, and we'll start seeing some real quality games.
I think that's a good point you've made. Like, it was very funny hearing about the shambles at the beginning, but there's a lot more to be said for it to be a good, entertaining, serious tournament. So, yeah, it's a good point you've made there, Bissy. I agree with you.
I tuned into the Egypt highlights from yesterday. I can't remember who they were playing. I think it was Sudan. And it was just not a good game to watch, even the highlights of it. I mean, when Mo Salah, we did speak, like, obviously he's not surrounded by the same quality of players that he is at Liverpool, so he's not going to shine in the same way. But even when he did try and spark to life, there was so little action around him, so few options, that his only option was to try and jink through a load of players and, like, force it in that way. And you could see that his skills weren't being employed to maximum effect because he just doesn't have the same quality around him. And I just, you know, I do think there's like a canyon of quality between the African Cup of Nations and the football we're used to watching, at least in the top European league. So it might sound a bit disparaging, but there is just levels to everything, isn't it? And the African Cup of Nations is rather near the bottom of the international scale.
And isn't that interesting? Don't you think that kind of dispels the sort of FIFA mentality that, I don't know, I'm not going to put a figure on it, let's say 80% of football fans might have, where they think Mo Salah's playing for Egypt, they should win the AFCON. They should win the whole tournament. He's the best player in the world. Therefore, they should win the tournament. But as you just said, like when you've got players around you of quality, not only do they provide you with a passing option quicker and a better passing option than all these players might do, but they're also dragging the opposition out of positions so that they're deliberately sort of dragging opponents out of positions or into positions where Mo Salah can exploit. And essentially what you want to do is, Mo Salah's good in one-on-one situations. He can beat players one-on-one. But when you put two or three players on him because, you know, his teammates aren't getting into positions where he can either play a 1-2 with you or can drag another player out of position, then it becomes difficult. You know what I mean? You can't just expect a player to beat three or four players and do everything on his own. Football doesn't work like that. At the end of the day, it's a team game made of one-on-one battles on the field, but it's one-on-ones, not two, three-on-ones. Do you know what I mean? He's not going to be able to beat players like that. So it's interesting that you bring that point up about there being other quality on the field, because it is so important, and people, you know, football fans should understand that. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, Egypt won't be one of the tournament favourites now. I think they probably were at the start of the competition, but it's Cameroon, Senegal and Nigeria now, and they're the bookies' joint favourites after all three teams and now through to the group stages. Obviously, Nigeria, the Super Eagles, are the only team to win all three of their group stage games and progress on 9 points. Cameroon have the top goal scorer so far, Vincent Aboubakar, who's already got 5 goals and like looks almost a certainty to finish top goal scorer because he's 3 ahead of everyone else with sort of going into the last 16 ties. Obviously, Egypt and Mo Salah, as we just spoke about, they're going to go into the last 16 as runners-up in Group D. So they're going to be joined in the runner-up places by either Burkina Faso, Guinea or Gabon. So you would assume, and I think that might be finalised now. I think there's a couple of games to be played in sort of Group C and Group F. Ghana, hugely disappointing. We know Ghana from the World Cup and how successful they were in the World Cup in the past. Obviously, we've mentioned that Uruguay game, I think it was a quarterfinal, World Cup quarterfinal in 2010, did we say, or 2014? I think 2010, the Suarez incident.
I think that was 2010. And also, they got to either the round of 16 or the quarterfinals against Brazil in 2006, I think it was. So they've got form. That was when like Michael Essien was playing for them.
Yeah, so huge international pedigree. Yeah. And obviously, they finished bottom of Group C, got beat by Comoros, Morocco, and only managed a draw against the other team in the group. And this was probably, I think it is, the worst performance by their senior national team in African Cup of Nations history. Algeria, I've written down their huge task to escape an elimination. They've lost to Ivory Coast this afternoon, 3-1. They finished bottom of their group after losing to Sierra Leone and Guinea as well. I think they got a draw against Sierra Leone, actually, and then they drew and they lost to Equatorial Guinea. And they were one of the tournament favourites as well. They won it 2 years ago, so they're current holders. Obviously, you got Riyad Mahrez, West Ham star Saeed Benrahma in their team, Islam Slimani. So they got decent players like that you would expect. You know, they expect them to go further. And I've sort of contradicted myself about what I said about Mo Salah. But, you know, that's how you gauge it, really. With the African combinations, you do gauge it by the amount of quality they have in a team. So having one player is probably not going to be good enough. But if you've got 3 or 4 Premier League player quality in that team, you'd expect them to go a lot further in the group stages. So another massive underachiever. So the last 16 looks a little bit like this. So Cameroon, they're going to set up a tie against best placed third from either group C, D or E. So that could be a potential matchup with Algeria. Oh, it's not anymore because they didn't beat Ivory Coast. So they'll play the team that finished third in that group. Nigeria will play the best place finisher B, group B, E or F. And there's quite a few permutations that need to be decided for that. And then Egypt, I think, play Ivory Coast in the last 16. So that's going to be another one of the sort of like top five in the betting are going to be exiting at that stage. And Senegal will probably play Cape Verde or Sudan. So you'd expect them to go through to the quarterfinals.
You watch Mo Salah absolutely rip it up now in this next game after
we've guaranteed. We've given the ball chat the ball chat curse, haven't we? Or so the opposite of a curse, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. But he's definitely going to do well now, yeah.
That's how much I like him. I said it on purpose. I wanted him to bounce back in form.
The ball chat bad take.
No.
And it. Go on then, Jim. Go over some of the transfer news for us.
Well, there's been a lot going on, to be fair, and a lot of it revolves around Newcastle. Eden Hazard and Danny van der Beek have both rejected moves to Newcastle. Hazard for a transfer amounting to 40 million that had already been agreed by Real Madrid president Florentino Perez for a player he paid 88 million for just in 2019. And that tells you all you need to know about Hazard's time at the Bernabeu. Van der Beek rejected a loan move to the Magpies in the belief he can establish himself in the first team at Old Trafford under Ralf Ragnarok. Basically, both these players reckon Newcastle is beneath them. It's difficult to argue, especially with Hazard's past achievements. You would have seen the meme picture of him in the Super Cup final. He is not a happy bunny, is he, in his new role at Real Madrid. He arrived overweight, has nursed several injuries since he's been there. He just needs to get playing again. Well, maybe he's just happy to sit there like Gareth Bale. Danny van der Beek, it's a bit of a strange one because as highly as everyone rates him, he's simply not getting starts at Old Trafford. So it all comes down to that age-old question that you can apply to Jesse Lingard as well, who's also the subject of some intense speculation regarding Newcastle. What do you want to do? Do you want to sit on the bench at a big club or do you want to play football? There are masses of money to be made when you go there as well, which is also a concern. But I think Newcastle are going to have more success going for players like Bayer Leverkusen left back Mitchell Bakker. He's a Dutch under-21s international. He's also played at PSG, I think. You know, with guys who are not established in a commercial sense but are highly rated on training grounds around Europe, I think they're going to have more success kind of dangling the financial carrot in front of lads like that instead of someone like Hazard who's got Premier Leagues, Champions Leagues under his belt, etc. And Danny van der Beek, who's like absolute superstar in his native Holland before he made the move to Manchester.
More success, absolutely. But I think this window is more about desperately trying to stay up. Signing young talent who need time to develop might as well wait until the summer, I'd say. What do you think?
I'd have to agree, right, Flynn, I'd say. Yeah, yeah, on that regard. But as Jim was intonating to just a second ago, like if you do go and throw a lot of money at these stars that are 30, 31, obviously great players like Eden Hazard, you know, and even if they were going to go with someone like Ousmane Dembele as well, who has rejected a contract at Barcelona and they want him out as soon as possible, I'd imagine that he's probably rejected it because they were like, right, we're not going to pay you 250 grand a week anymore. Here's like 120. And he's probably said, oh, nah, I can probably go and get 250 at Newcastle. So I wouldn't be surprised if that a player that's on their radar. And he's 24. Signing players like Hazard, 31. What is he, something like 29? Yeah, anyway, he's in the sort of twilight of his career or whatever. I would imagine that they need something in between that, don't they? I think I agree with what Flynn said last week about Chris Wood. They need players that are proven in the Premier League that are going to come and do a job straight away. You know, this Mitchell Bakker, who I don't know much about, obviously, you know, he's playing for Bayer Leverkusen, very respectable club. I'm not sure if he's playing week in, week out for him. I do feel like if he needed time to adapt, they haven't got enough time to do that. So I would say they need players like Chris Wood that are ready made to come in and perform in the Premier League, keep them up. And then that's the sort of player that can go for in the summer. Eden Hazard, on the other hand, would be the sort of player that you don't really want. I'm not sure you really want a player like him coming into the club when you're in a relegation dogfight, man.
Well, you know, you've alluded to it in past episodes quite a few times that there has to be a contingency plan in place at Newcastle because they are in deep trouble, no matter how much money they throw at this problem at the minute. So I don't think it's the worst idea to bring in a player like Bakker who's played European football. What better way to introduce him into the English game than in the Championship where everyone's scrapping for their lives? Like, the technical aspect isn't as high as it would be in the Premier League, but the physicality of it is definitely there, probably more so. So I don't think it's the worst idea, but I do accept what you're saying. They need players to do the job immediately if they're going to retain their commercial status as a Premier League outfit. Absolutely. But the bat signal's gone up for Luis Suarez from the roof of Villa Park, man. Stevie G is reportedly compelling another former teammate to join his Villa side after Felipe Coutinho scored in his debut against United last week. Suarez is 35, but it's still been an astonishing addition to this team. half a season with him leading the line is worth a few points, man, surely. It doesn't get any better for Villa fans, does it? Sorry, Bishop.
No, I tell you what, the commercial appeal of bringing him to Villa probably is more valuable than the appeal that you'd have on the team, on the field. I just think it's just unbelievable that these are the sort of players that are being touted now. Like, it really, Stevie G has landed, man. Absolute orchestra conducting. Honestly, man, levels, absolute levels of what he's doing there. Villa fans must be absolutely fucking at the biggest fucking boners they've ever had in their life, man.
This is like when you start a career seasons on FIFA as Villa. You're like, yeah, you do like five seasons, you just smash it and you're on easy mode. So you've got all the funds you need. And just signed Coutinho, Suarez, finished top of the league, 120 points, undefeated. Like, absolutely killing it.
Unbelievable. And he's a goal and assist as well, man. Last week on his debut, he was only on the pitch for like 20 minutes as well, wasn't he?
That was straight out of Southgate's book. Bring on the super sub, 70th minute, boom, change the game.
Yeah, mate. Absolute unbelievable, man.
The water boy playbook.
And I don't really want to speak too much. But what a contrast Villa and Blues are at the minute. And, you know, there was a time where we were aligned. You know, we were equals, you know, a few years ago, maybe a decade or so ago, probably longer than that. But we were briefly equals. And now Villa just like leaving us in the dust, man, completely. Like, honestly, it's you couldn't have. I don't think the quality between the two teams has ever been so far apart. I can't think. I watched Blues the other night. I've watched Blues quite a few times this season. Like, honestly, you know what we were doing? And I don't want to make this another rant about Blues. But like the back three would get the ball and they'd be so scared about playing a forward pass into someone in midfield. They'd just go back to Effridge, man. They're just blind. You know what? I'm just going to go back to the keeper and he's just going to smash it long so we can hopefully get a flick on in it. That is how bad it has got at Blues, man. Absolutely, like, despicable, really. All right, should we do the five things?
Yep.
All right, number one, in women's football, Nadia Nadim, a 34-year-old Danish player currently at Rathing. Do you like that, Flynn? Rathing.
Loved it.
Rathing Louisville FC, has had an astonishingly remarkable life thus far. Born in Herat, Afghanistan at the age of 11, or she wasn't born at the age of 11, that's how that sounded, isn't it? She was born in Afghanistan and at the age of 11, and you shouldn't be laughing because this is actually really sad, like what I'm about to say. At the age of 11, her and her family had to flee the country after her father, who was a general in the Afghan armed forces, were executed by the Taliban in 2000. She then moved to Denmark and began her footballing career at the age of 16, playing for B52 Aalborg. And has since gone on to represent Man City and PSG, along with a century of appearances for Denmark. She speaks 11 languages and last week qualified as a doctor after 5 years of studying whilst earning a living playing football. So that's pretty remarkable, wouldn't you say, lads?
No, not really.
No, no, actually, I speak 12 languages if you include the dialects of Catalonia and...
I bet at least six of them languages are almost the same. You know what I mean?
Ah, yeah. Look at him fucking pissing on her achievements, man. Slack.
No, it's an amazing story. Yeah, absolutely inspiring.
You know, I think more impressive than all those stats is the fact that she's not bad looking either. So.
You misogynistic bastard, yeah. But elsewhere in the women's game, the tie between Barcelona and Real Madrid in the Champions League in March at the Nou Camp has sold out after the full capacity of 85,000 tickets were snapped up in 3 days. It's possible that the Barcelona Femini, after 113 wins and 25 draws with zero losses in 2021, in a calendar year, and scoring an incredible 443 goals, are possibly the biggest sports pool in Barcelona right now. What do you think? And then the goal difference, by the way, after 17 games this season, is plus 94. Absolutely ridiculous.
Whilst an impressive statistic, I've got a feeling this says a lot more about the quality of the other teams, though.
That's sexism, straight sexism, man. Strong woman, give it all you got, fighting to the top, strong woman.
Oh yeah, he's fucking the PC principal, isn't he? Jim is the PC principal of this podcast, man.
The misogynistic PC principal.
Oh yeah, looks for dudes.
I'd say the same the other way. If there was a men's team with this much of an advantage, I'd say the same thing. Like, they're in the wrong league.
Nah, to be fair, they wouldn't. Like, look at Man City. Man City are basically in the wrong league, aren't they? Like, do you know what I mean? This season, at least. But, yeah, I think, obviously, there's a lot of catching up to do, isn't there? I think the teams that have got the money and the resources are, like, in the women's game anyway, they're like so far ahead of everyone else. And that's what's happened with the US women's team at a national level, is that for like the last 20 years, like, teams haven't been able to compete with the US. So I'm going to make a prediction right now on the podcast that's hopefully going to be better than the last international prediction I made, which was Turkey to win the fucking Euros. And then they didn't win a game, like, conceded 10 goals. And that was that. But I reckon Spain, the Spanish women's side, obviously that consists of a lot of these players that are playing for Barcelona. I think they've got like Lieke Martins, who's a Dutch international, I believe. And I think they've got a Nigerian international in there as well. But a lot of them are Spanish. They've got that Alexia Putellas, who's just won the female Ballon d'Or. So she's been sort of like the best player in the world in the women's game. But I think Spain are going to win the World Cup next year, the Women's World Cup. I think they'll beat US in the final. So there's my prediction. I think France will get to the semi-final. Either US or Spain will beat them in the semi. And then maybe, US and Spain will play in the final. I think Spain will win it. So there's my prediction.
Not exactly left field, is it, man?
What do you mean?
Spain are going to win the...
What do you mean? US
bold prediction there, visit.
US have dominated the women's game for like fucking two decades. So how is that not a bold prediction?
Anyway, how adventurous.
Quite the hot take you've got there, mate.
hot. Anyway, number two. The Cincinnati Bengalis won their first playoff game in 31 years on Saturday, ending the league's longest drought. Rookie wide receiver Jamar Chase, who is having a spectacular season in his first year in the league, breaking rookie and franchise records in the process, managed 116 yards over 9 receptions and even pitched in with some rushing yards during the 26-19 defeat of the Raiders. So the Bengals will now go on and play second seed Tennessee Titans for a place in the AFC Championship game.
This game was on during the darts tournament last weekend, which I shamefully crashed out in the first round after being one of the top seeds. But family honor was restored by Jack Allen, who came through all the way to the final. Tony Montana himself, the mongoose. He went all the way to reserve our pride. But it threw me off that the visiting team has their logo on the left. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the visiting team comes first out of the two. Yeah, that is so confusing. But it's American sports, and they have to do things differently. I don't think there's any actual logic behind that.
Well, Pizzy had to explain to me what was going on. And through my... I was crestfallen, I'll be honest. And I'd had a few Westerns and I just wasn't in the right frame of mind to be taking on the quite complicated rules and little traditions that go along with an NFL game. So I'm still learning, but I can't say I've put that much effort into them.
Who beat you in this start tournament, by the way?
Oh, the Cobra, the King Cobra himself, Ben Gilmartin. He was a late replacement, man. He was drafted in on 45 minutes notice, came in, wiped the floor with me, man. Absolutely ridiculous. This should have been the preamble ramble this week.
It should have been. And who beat Big Red? His mate, innit?
Equally Big Charlie, yeah. That was it. Stitch got all the way to the final, but wasn't to be. So on to the next one, lads. Sorry to distract from this. This has come up like a PTSD flashback as you've been talking about the NFL. Sorry.
Well, I'm glad that the Allen family honor was restored. So that's good. Number three, a video was surfaced of England captain Joe Root and veteran bowler Jimmy Anderson reportedly up all night getting pissed with the Aussies after the 4-0 demolition down under in what will arguably go down as one of the worst England Ashes performances. Joe Root, after a lot of heavy criticism regarding his leadership and decisions on and off the field, was kicked out from a hotel in Belrive, Tasmania. In the early morning after the conclusion of England's fifth test. So the ECB have launched an investigation after police ended up being called to England's team hotel after somebody from the hotel obviously had grassed them up. So would you say this is unprofessional? Would you say it's elite sports people letting off some steam? I'm like, let's have it right. Remember, I think it was 2005 when, England won the Ashes, and you can't tell me that like Freddie Flintoff and like Kevin Peters were not steaming when they rocked up at like 10 Downing Street to meet like the Prime Minister, whoever it was at the time, Tony Blair, I don't know. Flim will know, trivia man.
Well, they're letting our cricket standards slip, but at least they're upholding one fine English tradition of getting absolutely slaughtered and kicked out of hotels when they're abroad. So fair play to the boys. They might have got smashed in the Ashes, but at least they're holding up some traditions. Up the boys.
I say sack the lot of them. Unprofessional, damage the brand, get them off the team.
The brand.
Number four. And we'll see where you stand on this one, company man. What would you do in this situation? So Jose Mourinho supposedly has been quoted saying that when he was head coach of Manchester United, Anthony Martial sent some, quote, weird pictures to his daughter. And now we aren't privy to the exact content of said photos, but we don't need to have a vivid imagination to have a guess what they might have been. I'd say probably just him with his top off, innit? Surely just his top off, innit? Nothing more than that.
Yeah, too bad the picture was of his bottom half. No wonder he's losing games at Roma. Martial's six-pack on his daughter's screensaver just haunted his dreams.
Oh, dear. I'd imagine that's a pretty difficult dynamic, like having, like, you know, a good-looking daughter when you're, like, the manager of, like, a huge football team that has, like, ultra-fit athletes and, like, probably surrounding the kind of, like vultures in a way. And you know what footballers are like, man? They've got this sort of, like, this kind of, like, ingrained sort of... What's the word?
Tendency to rape.
Incestuous. Yeah, that as well. But, like, an incestuous nature, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, obviously, JT shagging, like, Wayne Bridges. You find a lot of it, like, you know, sharing lovers kind of thing. And I think this probably ties into it. And, like, it must be mad, though, ain't it? Like, going... Like, you're just not going to start, are you? You're just going to get fired. Well, like, sacked. Obviously... Martial got the last laugh, though, because Mourinho got sacked and he stayed there, innit?
And
probably rattled his daughter as well, so...
I think she was seven.
Now. We shall not talk about... I think she's like 20, but like, yeah. Martial's young as well, don't forget, so...
Memories of Tim Henman now.
All the lads on Henman Hill.
What's Henman ever done to you, Jim?
What? Okay, I don't want to repeat it on the podcast, man. Yeah.
All right, and number five, Fulham are just the sixth team in senior English league history to score six or more goals in three successive matches after Plymouth, Chester, Everton and Chelsea, along with the first team to do it in 1893, Small Heath Alliance. Flynn will probably know who that is. This team, of course, is the predecessor to Birmingham City, the team that that managed to achieve the feat against on Tuesday night. It's been a bit of a blues episode, this, isn't it? And also, Tino, cheers for the 20 quid. So Chelsea did this in 2010. They beat Wigan 8-0 and 6-0 under Ancelotti on either side of two league seasons. That probably wouldn't have been a good quiz question if you had not sacked it off completely.
I don't know. I think I'm going to call this episode Blues Balls or Blue Balls or something like that.
Go on, should we do the combat sports then?
Yeah, let's do it, man. So combat sports from last week, UFC featherweights Giga Chikadze and Calvin Kattar damaged the quality of their later lives on Saturday night. This fight was probably what springs to mind when your auntie thinks about cage fighting. Just so much blood, so aggressive. You know, they had no regard for each other's safety. And you might think, yeah, obviously it's a cage fight. But there was this I go, you go pattern to the fight that both of them embraced. It was kind of disturbing. And in that type of scenario, one man usually breaks down. But this one went to the cards. Kattar took the wide unanimous decision by walking Chikadze down, absorbing what he had to absorb, which was an awful lot at times, and jumping on takedowns when they presented themselves, something Dominic Cruz certainly appreciated on the commentaries. Kattar even managed to control Chikadze on the ground for the majority of the first, which was unexpected between two strikers. Overall, he looked for any excuse to throw elbows, and he closed the distance really well with his front kick, two weapons that complement his boxing style quite nicely. Kattar's a pretty good talent, man. I think he's ranked fifth going into this fight. Surely he'll move up in the rankings after this. He's only been beaten by Max Holloway and Zabit Magomed Sharipov in the last 3 years. So this was a big step forward towards a title shot again, which, you know, he was obliterated by Holloway. I think he was absorbed something like 1,000 strikes to the head and just kept walking forward. He's got a capacity to absorb punishment, but I worry for a fighter who depends on his chin quite that much. It was also Chikadze's first defeat after 9 wins in a row. And based on this fight, when he commits, he looks like he hits very hard. But he also showed how open he can be as well. He had two black eyes and a busted nose, and that was evidence of the punishment he took by the end. Although Kattar wasn't looking too fresh himself.
Yeah, that's probably the only thing I did see about this card and this fight, really. I just saw them both looking very, very worse for wear. So it kind of like, it was in tune with what you're saying about how they were just like both absolutely giving each other hell, to be honest. And I think Chikadze, the Georgian, he was like I want to say he was the favourite going into the fight.
I think so. Don't quote me on that, but there was definitely a lot of hype with him because of how he hits and how much he commits to his attacks. I think in Cater, he met someone with commensurate skill, but also an immovable chin. And I think he'll have to make some major adjustments in his style if he's going to crack like the top five, top four, and possibly get a title shot. But over to the boxing from last weekend, and WBO light heavyweight champion Joe Smith Jr., he defended his title against late replacement Steve Geffrard, who was standing in for a COVID-infested Callum Johnson. Geffrard actually lost his first two pro fights, then put together 18 straight wins to earn this title shot, which he got on a week's notice, so good lad for sticking with it. And it turned out to be great matchmaking to bring him in because him and Smith Jr. were well matched. Smith Jr. had the power edge and looked to impose that every chance he got. And credit to him, there were times when he stood off and bounced around and jabbed, but he was only ever a second away from opening up with these big winging shots and sometimes in long combinations. In these moments, all Geffrard could do was tuck up and ride it out, but he kept his head. He had a nice tight guard and looked to counter with short punches whenever Smith Jr. would get going. I thought his left hook was a particularly effective weapon, something he used less and less as the fight wore on, as Smith battered that side of his guard relentlessly with these big overarching right hands. But when they exchanged, it was always Geffrard who had to give the ground. Smith Jr. punches so hard and so often, it just isn't worth trying to stay in there with him and finish the exchanges. And through the middle round, Smith, he took on a casual air, and it was like he made up his mind that he couldn't be hurt, and all he had to do was keep swinging, and that's the way it turned out. Geffrard shipped some heavy shots from the fourth and fifth round onwards, and by then his durability slowly cracked as the minutes went on. He came out to the ninth round pretty much already beaten. It was like an act of submission when he went to the corner and kind of absorbed the last volley of punches from Smith Jr. And he earned his right to submit on that basis because he put up a good showing on late notice. And I actually think he'd beat Callum Johnson, the man originally slated to step into this contest. So
that's really interesting, Jim, because I think you were saying last week that you thought, you know, he wasn't going to cause any Smith Jr. any issues, and he was probably just going to come in. It was going to be a bit of a non-event. So it's also good for him. I think I was reading that that's now Smith Jr.'s third scheduled opponent for his first title defense, unless I'm mistaken. Is that right?
I think him and Vlasov were scheduled to have a rematch after they fought for the vacant title a couple of months ago. Again, don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's the way it was going. And then Callum Johnson is not nearly as mobile and doesn't have the counter-punching ability that this Geffrard showed. It's not that he caused Joe Smith Jr. a lot of issues. It's just that he showed that he was competent enough to stay in there with him. And I think with more notice, he possibly could have gone the distance. I think he would have done very well to beat Joe Smith Jr. just because I don't think he had the power to hurt him. I think that was the main difference, really. Other than that, his technique was good. He seemed willing and he seemed capable and competent and willing to punch when he needed to, even though he was shipping some heavy shots. Moving on to the preview for next week. It's a massive one. UFC 270, Francis Ngannou versus Cyril Gane for the undisputed heavyweight championship. Anyone even half interested in this fight should watch Dan Hardy's BT Sports breakdown. He made a compelling case for each fighter to win. But here's the fight in simple terms. Both of these guys stand over 6 feet, 4 inches and weigh over 17 and a half stone. And Ngannou punches so hard, I'm beginning to suspect he sold his soul somewhere down the line between Cameroon and Spain. Like, he's a freakish puncher. And then Gane, he dances around like a welterweight and he's got every trick in the book. They used to train together in the same gym. And the sparring footage seems to favour Gane, but everyone acknowledges that could be misleading. Overall, I think Cyril Gane is the more accomplished fighter, technically and strategically. And Ngannou can knock anyone out with a single punch, and that's just straight fact. I'm surprised his opponents don't wake up speaking another language and being like fluent in piano. It's devastating what he does to him. And that's his clear advantage. The areas where Gane is miles ahead are his cardiovascular endurance and his accuracy. I could definitely see him pecking away for 5 rounds, exhausting, demoralizing Ngannou. 25 minutes of perfection, like a real operatic performance. I could definitely see that going down. But that would be some statement, you know, the perfect way to win the title. I can also see Ngannou sweeping forward and edging the fight inside a minute. I think that's probably the most likely outcome, you know. The longer this fight goes on, it's less likely that will happen. But I'm still picking Francis Ngannou to win by knockout.
I'm ready for this one. I think this is going to be huge. I think all the hype is real. Even Uncle Dana, I mean, I suppose he would be going off on this, but this is what he's had to say. He says, you've got two guys that are former training partners. They came out of the same camp. Now they don't like each other. This is probably the second or the third time I've said this in my career, but Vince McMahon could not write a better script than this.
So I'm going to sacrilege.
What do you think? Do you think this has got the potential to eventually be talked about in the same breath as like, you know, the John Jones and DC fights or the Brock Lesnar era of heavyweight fights in the UFC? What do you think?
Yeah, like no fights guaranteed to produce entertainment, but all the UFC can do is put the right ingredients in the pot and just light the flame underneath it, you know? And I think this is going to be quite a flavorful dish. I'm going to stop extending that metaphor now.
How much more can you do with that? Like, I reckon you can do a bit more with that. Go on. No, Francis and Garnish.
Well done. Oh. Well done, lad. I like that. Yeah, Francis and Garnish. No, but I think this is, yeah, it's heavyweights. They're well matched. They've both got experience with each other. It's a big stage. It's going to be a packed arena. Bissett, who'd you favour in this fight?
You know me. I'll always use the bookies odds as a kind of a general guide as to where the fight might be going. But to be fair, this is one of the closest in terms of the betting market that I have seen from a main card in a long time. Cyril Gane is the slight, ever so slight favourite. Probably just under even money, something like 4-7, 4-6, you can probably get as a favorite. And then Ngannou will probably be about 5-4, just over even money. So honestly, the bookmakers, they're too afraid. They're really too afraid to go heavy either way. I think a lot of money, wherever the money goes, that'll kind of decide who the favorite is come the day, whether that's flipped over. And you know, Cyril Gane becomes the outsider and Garner becomes a favourite. But you can't, obviously, Gane's beat Derek Lewis, I think, who Ngannou lost to, I believe. I think he's got 3 losses on his record, Ngannou. Obviously, Cyril Gane's yet to be defeated in the UFC. I'm not sure where he was before the UFC. Was he somewhere else? Was he, I don't know. Was
he's 10-0, and I think he's been in the UFC since his third or fourth fight. And I think he fought in France shortly after MMA was decriminalized before that. So I think because of the gym he comes from and because his proximity to Ngannou, I think that's what kind of bolstered him into the UFC. And then when he stepped into the cage, he was just the fighter you see now, just cool, collected, capable, and willing to experiment against less able opponents, where a lot of the time, the big stage, it freezes people, and Cyril Gane is not one of those personality types at all.
And he's got one of those sort of those freakish abilities to use his power, his weight, and also that agile sort of dexterity that you see with some of these very, very few of these heavyweight fighters. So you know, it's a real mystery, really, in terms of his physicality. So It's hard. I find it hard to bet against him, man. It really is. And obviously, you made a good point about like Ngannou and sort of the strength that he hits with and the power that he has in his hands. You know, how much of that is going to count when he's? It's a really tough one. And the fighting styles are completely different as well, aren't they? I suppose could you say,
if this was a boxing match, I would be far less eager to cite Ngannou's power as the deciding factor. But the fact that they're wearing smaller gloves and the fact that those smaller gloves enable punches that wouldn't get through in a boxing ring to get through in the cage, and the fact that you need less contact to do the sort of damage you need to knock somebody out, I feel like the margin for error for Cyril Gane is extremely small. Now, we saw the recipe to beat Ngannou when Stipe Miocic did it, but the fact is Ngannou showed improvement since that fight. I'm not saying he's like a really sick wrestler. He's not like a great submission artist, but I think he knows just enough to minimize the threats to him in that area. I think if the fight stays standing, every time Gane prods at his legs, every time he faints, every time he tries to draw a reaction out of Ngannou, he's in real danger until Ngannou gets exhausted. And depending on Ngannou's conditioning, that could be a real problem for 15 minutes at the very least. So I understand, yeah. I'm finding it difficult to pick. I'm only slightly siding with Ngannou because, as I said, I can see Gain controlling it, and it would be like a virtuoso performance if he managed to do that. And I'd be like just as appreciative of that as I would be of an early knockout from Ngannou.
And is there much going on the undercard of this one?
Yeah, the main chief support on the bill is the trilogy fight between Brandon Moreno and Davison Figueiredo for the flyweight title. These two fought each other to a standstill in December 2020, and the resulting draw meant they were back at it the following June, where Moreno pulled out the third round rear naked choke for the surprise win. I haven't got a clue who wins this. If Figueiredo manages to take his title back, who knows? They might even do it for a fourth time. But I'm expecting it to be a good one because the second one especially was an emotional moment to see this underdog win after sticking in there after a gruesome start to the first fight. He made the adjustments he needed to make, showed a great jab, and really went looking for that rear naked choke, which is something a lot of people weren't expecting based on Figueiredo's background in jiu-jitsu. So very much looking forward to that one. And Michel Pereira, who we spoke about last week and the week before, has been rescheduled again to be on the undercard of this. So that just shows you how much they value his entertainment that he brings to the cage with his backflips and whatnot, even though he's 58 years old rather than 27. And over in the boxing, it's a pretty quiet week again. Gary Russell Jr., he'll defend his WBC featherweight title against the undefeated Filipino Mark Magsayo in Atlantic City on Saturday night. Russell Jr. stopped the current champion for the IBF, Kiko Martinez, in five rounds in 2019. He's also beaten Jojo Diaz and Patrick Harland in recent years. In fact, he's only lost to Vasyl Lomachenko, and that was 8 years ago now. I can't believe it. Before and since then, nobody has been able to handle his speed. And we'll see if Magsayo is the man to do it. But that's all for combat sports.
One thing possibly coming up in the future of the world of combat sports is MMA Sound have recently reported that Charles Oliveira may defend his lightweight title against Justin Gaethje at UFC 274 on May the 7th in Rio. However, I couldn't find any official confirmation from the UFC itself, so take that with a pinch of salt for now. Though, if it were to happen, who would be your picks to win that?
Love that fight, you know. Absolutely, yeah, love that too. Fight. That in Rio as well. I think you'd have to pick Oliveira, man. I mean, Gaethje, he doesn't aggressively wrestle. He loves to keep the fight standing. And I don't think he's got any advantages over Oliveira in the stand-up. And he certainly doesn't when it comes to the submission game, as we've seen him get choked unconscious by Khabib. You know,
good takedown defense, though.
Yeah, but Oliveira doesn't really take you down like that, does he? He kind of drags you to the fence and like wraps around your waist and then kind of climbs on your back from there. It's not like a straight shooting.
On, yeah, chokes you on your back. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'd have to favour Oliveira in that fight. Always, always Gaethje has the chance and the power to knock someone out. So I wouldn't rule it out completely, but definitely favour the champ in that one.
How about you, Biss?
Yeah, I'd probably have to go with Jim as well. Yeah, Oliveira. And to be fair, if you want to pay $75, the new price for the UFC subscription that Big Dane is coming out with, obviously he needs more money. He must be short of a few cash. So, but hopefully this money will be streamed back into his fighters. So who knows? Maybe that's where he's getting it from. But I can't see many people buying too many UFC subscriptions this year at that price, can you?
The Americans get absolutely raped for pay-per-view prices, you know. Like, even the boxing, it's like a standard pay-per-view. In a mismatch main event, it's like $70 or something. And, like, at least the UFC is providing a consistent product. Like, you can't always say that for boxing. But, like, there must be enough supply and demand there for companies to keep doing it. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And there's, like, 300 million Americans as well. That's mad cash, man. They get absolutely stung every time.
Over here, you can subscribe for about €10 a month to Marca. It's got all the Premiership football and all the UFC, but the commentary's in Spanish, so you got to put up with that.
Oh, that's all right. It's more exciting, isn't it? Go!
Yeah, isn't it? And they heard those, like, when the commentators are like, making motorbike noises, like, when a player's running fast. Jokes. But yeah, that's all we've got for this week. Another good episode, lads. Great to hear from you. We'll catch up again next week with a new episode. Number 50 next week. So I don't know if we're going to do anything special. You never know. We'll probably decide midweek, innit?
Stop calling Tim Henman a nonce for the 50th. We'll get straight back on it on the 51st.
Tim Henman's top 50 nonciest moments.
Give me 30 seconds, mate.
Yeah, I was going to say the top 50 that we'll do. The top 50 bodybuilders for Jim. How many bodybuilders can you name in a minute?
I'll go into that secret file on my phone marked work for those pictures.
All right. Cheers, lads. See you next week.